Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's May 13th, 2016. You're listening to the best poker cast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Bewildered Long.
Why are you bewildered?
Well, because you went through your normal Chris Cosenza panic mode.
Yeah.
You know, the TSA threat level.
Yeah.
Up to orange.
Yeah.
About the Skype connection not being strong today.
Never know.
And you're like, are you ready? And I'm like, I'm ready. And then, like, 4 minutes go by.
I told you, it's because it's working really slow. I hit the record button, and I'm sitting there waiting for it to start blinking. I'm telling you, there may not even be a show this week. That's all I'm saying. So if you guys are hearing this, you're fortunate, because I don't know what's going on.
One of my good friends just got a master's degree, and one of his professors said, hey, you should do a history podcast. So he sent me a message this morning, because he's like, you know, you're the podcasting king. And I'm like, not really. I'm more like the prince. Chris is the king, but whatever. And I'm like, it's awesome. You should do it. Have fun. Blah, blah, blah. And now I'm thinking, I did not mention to him the joys of recording on Skype.
Yeah. Even now, while you're talking, I'm trying to hit the mute button so I can hack. And it won't mute. So I'm hanging on to this cough so I won't cough. Then it like blinks red and white. And then it finally goes to mute. And then I hack. And then I go to unhack it. I need to make a comment. And it won't unmute. And I'm like, come on. So I'm a little worried about this show today, guys, but why don't we just get right to it?
So you like to be too polished. I don't mind having the cats and dogs just like
yes,
you.
we all know that. We hear the clicking and the moving around and the scratching your head so the headset mic gets all hit by the wire. Well, don't worry. They're all used to you. Don't worry.
I'm OCD, so.
Yeah. Go ahead. Do it all.
All right. Anyhow, so last week I attended another one of Danny Lobato's great charity poker events. Here in Tampa Bay, at Tampa Bay Downs, and if you guys have not heard of him, we did a profile on him in an issue not too long ago.
Not too long ago, yeah.
He really does a really good job. He does about four of these a year, and he's like, you know, people ask me to do even more, but I'm like, they have no idea what goes into running a good charity event, and I'm like, I know, but this guy is one of the folks that when charity folks call me up and say, hey, we want to have a charity poker tournament, I'm like, you need to look at what this guy does or what the Deep Stack Charity Classic guys do, and that's coming up here May 21st in Daytona Beach, so hopefully folks will see me there. Because that's really how you put on a good charity event, and it's not easy. It's not easy. You gotta really give good value, and Danny, you know, he gives a catered dinner as part of your buy-in, which is right. Nice, and then he really, really shakes the cup out in the community to get a lot of good donations for raffles and stuff. And that's what he has to do because, you know, obviously part of the prize pool goes to the charity. That's the whole reason to do a charity poker tournament is to raise money for charity. And we know how nitty poker players can be. So you have to replace that value that they lose from the prize pool with other stuff.
Right.
So anyhow, it was a great event, but two things came up that I want to talk about. And the first one, Chris, is I have a question. And why do people have to be ass pickles at a charity event?
Because it's charity.
So, you know, we had this one guy at our table, and he would not stop barking about the donkey play at the table. And he was like, oh, I've never seen stuff like this before. This is the worst play ever. I can't believe people make calls like that, blah, blah, blah. So for the longest time, he was on the other side of the table. My side of the table was kind of like giggling a little bit because we thought this guy was just hamming it up, right?
Yeah.
Because, of course, it's a charity tournament. You're not attracting the best and brightest of the poker world here, right? You're attracting the best and brightest people that want to kick leukemia's ass, right?
Right.
So, but he wouldn't shut up. And then eventually, at one point, one guy at the table turned to the guy. He's like, wait, hold on. Are you serious? And the guy's like, yeah. And he goes into this long tirade. And we're like, oh my gosh. This guy actually is openly criticizing the play at a charity tournament.
Oh, man.
So here's what I'm going to suggest to folks out there. It's I've got a radical thing. I spent a lot of time on my hands lately, and I came up with a solution for this really vexing problem for players who don't like the play in a charity poker tournament and don't like that a portion of the proceeds go to actually help a worthy charity, right?
Right.
Big problem in the charity world. I've got the solution, Chris.
I think I know what it's going to be.
The solution is, don't play. Boosh, mind blown.
You know, there's a couple of things I want to say about it. I know you probably got more to say, but one, when you join Fight Club, the first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. So, if you play a charity event, the first rule of a charity event is do not tap on the glass. You know, clearly these people, you must know going in that a lot of them aren't going to know what they're doing because they're there for a charity. So, don't make them feel terrible and not want to play. Learn how to play against people who don't know what they're doing. That's where you get all your chips from. How many times have you and I cashed in the Deep Stack Charity Classic at Daytona Beach? I mean, it's because you know that you're going in. Those are people from, you know, all over the place that want to support these great causes who aren't going to know how to play, you know? So the first thing is, you know, don't tap on the glass. And the second thing that, you know, you need to do when you're playing these things is you need to adjust, you know? I mean, I just don't understand it. I don't want to tell them not to play because I want them to, you know.
Yeah, let me clarify by what I mean by not play, you know. So obviously, if you show up at the poker room or you think about going to a poker room at this charity event, by all means, ask lots of questions. You know, it's important to know how much of the money is going to the charity, what the charity is anybody taking a piece of that for some kind of administrative fee? All those things are legitimate questions, and you should ask them ahead of time. But once you've asked those questions and you're satisfied with the answers and you plunk down the money, you've made a commitment to play that tournament, and you understand what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah.
So if you ask those questions and you don't like any one of the answers, you can wait till the next day when there's another tournament and play that. That doesn't have a charity component to it. That theoretically will have better players, and all the money will be going to greedy poker players instead of kicking leukemia's ass, you know?
Yeah.
You have a choice. I mean, why do you want to get into an event that you know is going to upset you, and then you are going to act like a Deutsche Bank at the table, make yourself look like a Deutsche Bank, and make the event less fun for the people that are there to have fun?
Yep.
That's what people were telling this guy. It's like, hey, we're just here having fun. And lots of people that were telling him that are good players that play there all the time. And tonight they knew that this was not their normal Tampa Bay Downs tournament that they play every night. Tonight was a different event. And they had a different mindset, and they're just having fun and moving chips around the table. And here's this guy that just, for whatever reason, thought it was going to be the final table of the November 9 for some stupid reason, and then made the rest of us feel uncomfortable. And that's just wrong.
It is wrong. It's a night. It's supposed to be a night of, you know, brotherhood, you know, coming together. And the other thing, too, is I wonder, and this isn't the cynical part of me, but I'm wondering, do you ever feel like there's a cynical part of this stuff? Like, a lot of these guys are playing these events because they know there's going to be a lot of, quote, donkey play, and so they're trying to take advantage of that.
This doesn't go their way, so that's when they get upset.
Yeah, and then, exactly. And that's why they're like, oh, I thought I was going to take advantage of all this. I was going to take advantage of the charity, you know? I mean, come on.
No, that's a good point. There probably are people that are like, hey, this is going to be a really soft field, and then they see that other people get all those chips from the soft players. Well, they get it in with pocket aces and lose to the guy that calls with 9-6, right?
Yeah.
And then they get upset because that's just how they are. They're angry people in general, right? They're probably the straddlers that decide, hey, I'm going to play a tournament tonight, right?
The straddlers. It gets called by the guy who calls with King 4 off because the King of Clubs reminded him of his Uncle Larry.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Right?
He looked like my Uncle Larry. I had to call. I was channeling him.
So that could be. So that's my advice to everyone out there. There are plenty of tournaments everywhere. So if one's not your liking, even if it's not a charity event, if it's one not to your liking, just don't play.
Yeah.
You're not going to play your best if you're already going into it upset anyhow. But especially for a charity event, people are here to make money to help a charity. People want to have fun in this tournament. And if you're going to detract them from having fun, please do us all a favor and just wait till the next day.
Yeah.
Or go play cash or do something else. You know, have some respect for those of us that are there to have fun and help a charity.
I smell a publisher's column coming along.
Only because you hate writing 10 of them a year, and I only write 2 of them.
No. You hold up your end of the bargain in the writing, believe me. I'm just saying, I can feel one of us is going to be writing this one pretty soon, I think.
All right, so another interesting thing happened. So there's one player at a table. And he was there really just to support the charity. He bought in, and he had another obligation to get to, so he knew he wasn't going to be able to be there for the long haul, right? So, now normally I would be kind of upset about this in a real tournament because it affects the play. But again, it's a charity event. We're all there to have fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this ended up being pretty fun to watch. So, obviously he knew he had to go. So, from the beginning of the tournament, he would shove blind every time. Wouldn't look at his cards, just shove a stack in. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And his idea was, you know, hey, somebody's going to get these chips and do good things with them, and I'm going to get to my obligation and my other obligation, and I've donated, you know, a decent amount of money to the charity by just simply buying in and not actually even playing poker, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, his first hand, again, I think he might have something like 9-6, and the guy calls him with pocket 10s, and he rivers a straight with his 9-6. Doubles up. Dope, right?
Yeah.
So now you feel bad because now this guy with pocket 10 thought, yeah, hey, I'm just doubling up on the first hand. Now this guy's rebuying. And the guy that wants to go home now has twice as many chips and is not going to be able to go home as quickly as he wants, because even if somebody calls him on the next hand, he's going to have twice as many chips.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yep.
So he does that. And then, like, two hands later, he gets called by pocket tens again and narrowly avoids turning or rivering a flush.
Oh, man.
And that holds up, so he gets half his chips away. And then on his final hand, he successfully avoided a runner-runner straight with another terrible hand. Any one of those scenarios go the other way, this guy has the ultimate chip lead, and he can't use the chips.
Makes you want to try that once in a while, doesn't it?
Yeah, actually.
Make sure you want to sit down and say, yeah, I can waste this $45. Let's try it. Let's see what happens.
I will say, from a poker strategy standpoint, maybe not strategy is the wrong word, but this is kind of what we talked about. Comes up in our roundtables and the crews often, you know, the Annette Oberstrad thing where, you know, you never look at your cards. She taped over the cards on the online screen, right? So she never knew what she had and played a whole tournament and won it, right? Famously. But it does show, I think, that, I mean, obviously, he was a big dog in a couple of these hands, right? But you're never out of it, really, until you're out of it.
Right. Chip in the chair.
So often these times that you're thinking about calling, oh, man, I don't know, you really are a lot more live than you think you are. And when you force yourself to be live, then you find out. Now, obviously, I'm not advocating the kill Phil strategy of shoving every hand and just hoping for the best, but it is an interesting lesson to watch. Because you don't see people do that very often, obviously. You know, no one's going to enter that nightly tournament and go, oh, man, I forgot I had to be somewhere 20 minutes from now and shove all the time.
I forgot about the Kill Phil book.
Yeah.
I forgot all about that.
Yeah.
Huh. I was supposed to say something about it. I don't know. No, I'm just saying I totally forgot about that book. And then that's what it was, right? It was, if it gets to you and you're the first in, shove. And I mean, there was more nuances to it, but it was basically that.
Designed for amateurs against pros.
Yeah.
General thesis. Obviously, it got more complicated if it went. But if you did the express version of the book, it was essentially saying pros don't like coin flips. They don't like putting their chips at stack with without a lot of information. Pros make their money because they're better than you at playing post flop, turn, and river. So if you make them make a decision for all their chips pre-flop, they know they're at a considerable risk because a lot can happen with those next five cards.
Yeah, yeah.
So now you're putting pressure on them. So they're probably going to fold more often than not, and then you're going to pick up some small pots. And when they do call, you'll find, as I just said, that you end up being more alive than you really think you are, and all things can happen. You can go, you know, get a four-card flush, or runner straight, or some weird thing like that, or some stupid two-pair that cracks the aces. All that stuff can happen.
Yeah, they're trying to take the luck out of it.
Right, exactly.
All right, earlier this month, masked gunmen barged into a poker room being held above a bar in Washington, D.C., but police say the robbers were apparently upset that they didn't get more loot. One of the players emptied a cash drawer containing about $1,000 into one of the robbers' duffel bags, and then the robbers reportedly started complaining that the amount should have been more.
All right, this is the all-aspicle edition of... Oh, because we're going to be talking about the Dallas Straddle here.
Yeah, it's going to be straddles later, too, so they're all ass pickles.
What I love about this is that, one, it's bad enough that people feel like they have to, like, rob to make their way in this world, right?
Yeah.
But then they get into here, and the money's not enough. So I'm curious as to why they thought there should be more there.
Maybe they won't. I mean, they must have got an inside scoop.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. I mean, right? maybe they had an inside scoop where someone said, "Oh yeah, man, there's like $10,000 on the table there every night," and that's why they signed to rob it, right?
Right.
Or they could just be like watching stupid poker TV shows and movies, right?
Right.
And like, oh, that's a poker game. It's got to be a lot of money there. And then get in there like, $1,000 bucks, is it? Are you serious? It does illustrate what happens when you have a game that's not in a casino, right? Yeah. And not to say that people can't rob you in a casino, which we're going to talk about later, too. But that's pretty scary. I mean, I never fear that anybody's going to, like, storm into our house with masks on and Uzi-like guns, which is what they're described here, and steal our Skittles, right?
Let me tell you, if they do that, they're going to be way disappointed. Even if they got $1,000, they wouldn't even come close to that. So they do big mistake. What way with three bags of Skittles if they're lucky?
So all right. So now here's my next question. So if you're in this game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now I don't know. I know I don't have the temperament of a young Doyle Brunson. Perhaps maybe you think you do. Do you go back to this game?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know.
As a player?
I don't know. I guess obviously they have a leak. There's a mole in the game. For someone to find out about it. So maybe I don't. I don't know. That's a good question. Probably not.
Well, I mean, I'm going to be, you know, I've been fortunate that I've never had any kind of thing like this happen ever, right? I've never been robbed ever in my life. Certainly not at gunpoint or anything like that. I don't have any kind of violent thing that's ever happened to me, which is really nice. Knock on every piece of wood I can find in my office here right now. After 44 years. So I don't know how I'd react, but I'm just thinking, as much as I hate guns, I'd be like, I don't need this in my life.
Yeah.
I'd be a little messed up, I think, for a while.
Yeah, yeah. It would definitely be a while before we did it, but we'd have to, like, vet everybody after that, I think. And just a little correction. Every time you've ordered a drink that you ordered from a restaurant or a cruise ship, you were robbed. Just so you know.
That is true, but not at gunpoint.
No, not at gunpoint, though. It's true. You weren't forced to pay $10 for a beer at the ballpark.
Alright, well, we asked if anybody had heard of this Ultimate Last Action Straddle that one of our Antiup cruisers told us about, and we heard from a couple folks, but no one gave us a better explanation than Mr. Reggie Trotter, who says he plays this game every once in a while at I believe Choctaw, he said, right?
Yeah.
So bear with me as we read through his very good example, and then we can we'll know better what this Ultimate Last Action Straddle, known as the Dallas Straddle, which doesn't surprise me.
Right.
It's the Texas people that came up with this, right? Because they like to play big, right?
Right.
All right, it says, this is only available from the button position, and it takes priority over a normal under-the-gun straddle. That means if the under-the-gun player elects to make a normal under-the-gun straddle, and the button elects the Dallas Straddle, I wonder if they have to say it that way. Dallas Straddle, please! The button gets priority, and the under-the-gun straddle would take his straddle back before the cards are dealt. So already you're the big fish there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you're already paying the butt.
All right, after the cards are dealt, the action would start with the under-the-gun player and proceed as normal until it gets to the button. Action skips the button, goes to small blind, big blind as usual, before going back to the button. Also known in history now as the Dallas Straddler.
Right.
That's going to be like a serial killer, right? Example one. In the event that there was a limp by a middle position and the cutoff player raised and folded around to the blinds, the limper would have to declare his actions before the action gets back to the Dallas straddle on the button. Example two. Assume the same facts as in example one, except the big blind elects to re-raise. The cutoff's open. In this case, the action would go as follows. The limper would declare his action, and the cutoff would declare his action, and then the button would be last to declare his action. Example three. Assume the same facts as in example two, except that after the big blind three bets and the limper folds, the cutoff elects to four bet. In this case, the action would go as follows. The action would skip the button again, go back to the big blind and declare his action before it goes back to the button for his action. As you can see, if there was a raising war between two players, the button gets to see all the action before it comes him to declare his action. We knew it!
Yeah.
Observations. He says, my thoughts are that it gives too much advantage to the button to not elect a straddle every time. However, I personally hate it because it actually ends up killing the game. Because of the advantage that it gives the button, it is the correct strategy to play tighter than normal. And after most of the table recognizes this, it is no good for the game. He says, I'm a regular player 4 to 8 times a month at both WinStar and Choctaw casinos, and I have never seen a Dallas straddle as an option in the games at WinStar. In addition to that, the only time it's generally available at Choctaw is at a 2-5 no-limit games and higher, and when there's a big tournament series in town. So before you all think that this area is nuts when it comes to our poker rules, this Dallas straddle only happens about 5% of sessions that a regular would play in.
Well, I had a decent back and forth with him about this too, and I asked him about it, and one of the things that it sort of validated for us was that it wasn't the same straddle because they didn't have it under the gun, because it on our ship we only allow it under the gun,
right?
So the guy who was telling us about it thought that he was going to get to do all that stuff under the gun straddle,
right?
And that's not true. So that was one thing too. He says it does it all the time at both casinos. According to Reggie, that's not true on both fronts, both casinos. He says he never saw it at WinStar, and two, that they only do it from the button. So it's the Dallas straddle, not the under the gun straddle. So, yeah, I think it's even worse now than ever. I mean, I really do. I just can't believe that people would want to play in this game unless they're the person who wants to do the Dallas straddle. If they all want to do the Dallas straddle, then whatever. Then they'll all know about it. But can you imagine the guy is like, you know what? I think I'm going to try my hand at 2-5 today. And all of a sudden, it's like, what? What? And jumping people and jumping back. And so the guy can see four bets if he wants before he has to even decide if he wants to play the hand. Of course you're going to straddle every time if you're the button now. It's a terrible rule.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't surprise me at all that he says that kills the game, because that's what I said, right? Because, you know, if I know the button can wait and see everything, one, there's no reason the button would never not straddle, right?
Yeah.
It'd be worth the $10 or whatever it is in the 2-5 to have that information. But then, you know, I'm really going to abuse people with it, I think.
That's crazy. And it's weird that we've never seen it, because someone else wrote into and said they saw it there too, and I thought, wow, so it's not just in Dallas either. You know, some people do it too, and we have never seen it in all the years we've played, and not like that. That's just crazy. I can't imagine saying, oh, guess what? You can turn back time now. You don't have to go clockwise. You can go, you know, you can skip me, and it's just not
well, right. I mean, what's next? Are we going to have, like, name that tune where you can, you know, bid after you see your cards?
Yeah.
I bid $16 to have the straddle.
That's right.
I say 20. No, 20. All right, you name that straddle. I mean, I guess poker people come up with anything they want to. I mean, look at open face or Chinese poker, and I mean open face. How many variations that's
got? Oh, I know.
And we've done local variations now on that too, which actually make the game better, by the way.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, if people could find a way to mess poker up, they will. So
it's time for ante updates. Harrah's Southern California is including an ante up poker cruise package for two. For our Alaska sailing, as part of the $10,000 in prizes it will be giving away in its cash and splash drawing on June 25th. Players can earn raffle tickets and cash games all month long in June. For more information on Antiope Poker Cruises, visit AntiopeCruises.com. Also, the schedule and details for our 2016 Antiope World Championship at Thunder Valley Casino Resort near Sacramento, California, have been released. The 20-event series will run from July 21st to August 7th and feature more than $1 million in guaranteed prize pool. The winner of the $1,650 buy-in main event will appear on the cover of Antiup as well. All details can be found at antiupmagazine.com/worldchampionship. Very exciting.
Yeah, very. He's Ben just went out of his way this year. I mean, it's just amazing what he's come up with. That main event's going to have a $500,000 guarantee. That's unheard of in the Sacramento area.
It's
up
huge.
There. So this is going to be big money and a big event, and people are already very excited about it. So hopefully we'll get to see a lot of you out there, and I'm looking forward to being out there for almost all of it. So
it's going to be huge.
Huge.
Each week, we spotlight a listener who emails us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, we send them something cool. This week's prize is a 30-minute telephone lesson and workbook from Thomas Gallagher Casino Seminars, which specializes in poker odds and math at poker911.net. Comes from Todd Falstad. Says, you may have heard about the recent shooting at Pottawatomie Casino. I know it was at the blackjack tables and involves motives of robbery, but, like I've said before, if a religiously motivated terrorist wants to find a cluster of people that obviously don't subscribe to his or her ultra-fundamentalist ways, a poker room might be a place they'd look. I'd like to see the No Concealed Weapons Permits sign at casinos come down or metal detectors installed at the entrances.
Yeah, this has been an ongoing conversation with Todd and I. It's been an interesting one for us because we're obviously on different spectrums of the gun debate. So certainly don't want to turn the show into political, so we're not going to. But I'm curious what you think about the safety here. So it's interesting to me that people have different views of safety, right? So I think this is where the difference between Todd and I are, and this is what I've communicated to him, is that for him, it seems like he doesn't feel safe unless he has his gun with him or other people have their guns with him because, and his point is that, you know, all right, so if you are looking to cause damage, you look around and you see a prominent sign that says, hey, concealed weapons not allowed here. You would theorize that, hey, I got a better chance of doing my carnage here than I do somewhere else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, which is my side, is I'm petrified of guns. I've always hated guns. And I feel less safe knowing that people are carrying guns than I do if people aren't carrying guns. And I just don't think that this scenario has ever happened. As far as I know, there's never been a jihad casino or poker room in all the years around. So it's not a big fear of mine, but my fear is that we know how heated people get at the poker table, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, you check raised me, or you slow rolled me, or how could you play with that garbage? I mean, we just saw the charity event, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And my fear is it's much more likely that if somebody has a gun with them, that they're going to use it for not protecting people or trying to stop a religious fanatic that's in there, you know, Yosemite Samming the place up. But it's going to be used to settle an argument at the table, and that's not safe for me.
Yeah, I'm on your side. I really don't want to dive too far into this because there's a lot of stuff here that, you know, affects me. But I agree. I would rather know that nobody had guns than everybody had guns. And I just, this is such a rare thing. One of the things that my daughter has a huge fear now of going to the movies, and she's starting to get over again because of all the shootings that happened.
Right.
And then I say to her, you know, so then for the longest time, she didn't let all these great movies were coming out, and the kids couldn't go see them. And we couldn't take the kids, you know, the grandkids and everything. And I'm like, you know, I really want them to see this movie in the theater experience, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, no, you know, she's looking for the exits. She's looking for who looks funny, you know. And you start doing that with everything. So now when there's car accidents, you're not going to drive your car. Or somebody intentionally swerves over the double line to kill themselves and take the person out with them. Now you're going to be afraid to drive in the left-hand lane, you know. I mean, for the rest of your life, you're going to live your life that way or whatever. So I don't know if I would be scared to go into a casino now because of this one nut job. Because if somebody's going to kill you or somebody wants to go crazy, they'll do it anywhere. And does it really matter that it was a casino this time? I mean, it could be... how many times we just saw stabbings at a mall? Are you going to now, you know, carry a knife with you wherever you go? Or, you know, I mean, there's just... When does it end? And where does it end? And I want to live my life. So I'm going to live my life and just hope, you know, that you know, things just work out. I can't just happen to, now I'm going to need a gun because somebody did that. I just don't see that happening.
Well, I think you stumbled onto the rarity thing. That's the big thing for me is that, I mean, you take away all the politics in this. It's just the rarity of it. I mean, obviously when there is a mass shooting, it gets massive media coverage, right? But, you know, one of my points that's odd was that you add up all the people killed in mass shootings over whatever period you want, and then add up all the people shot in non-mass shootings, and that number dwarfs that other number, right?
Yeah.
So that's not a political statement. That's just saying it's rare. So, but it, because it gets so much attention, I think it has a bigger effect on us. So I think that's what's going on with your daughter, right? It's not that there are shootings in theaters everywhere. There's been six that I can think of, right?
Right.
But because I got so much coverage, now you start thinking, you know, hey, it seems like a bigger deal than it really is. And as my wife always tells me, fear is not rational, right?
Right. It's not.
So, you know, you could be afraid of whatever you want for whatever reason. That's just how we're wired as humans. So, but to me, it's a rarity thing, whereas I think it would be much more likely that someone's going to just get upset or get drunk or whatever and pull out the gun and cap somebody and then graze them and then boom, hits me and I'm like, I'm just here to play cards, man.
Yeah, dude, I didn't do anything. I didn't check raise you.
But I will say that I don't think I would have a problem with metal detectors at casinos.
Yeah.
I'm one of these people that doesn't really mind the TSA. Partly because now I'm pre-checked, so I don't have to do the ridiculous take my shoes off stuff that I don't think actually works, right? But
right.
But I don't have a problem. You know, I do a lot of history tours, and if you go to any state house around the country to do the tour, you got to go through a metal detector. You know, I did the United Nations tour, and you had to go through metal detectors. Yeah, it's pretty easy now, right? You know, you take your stuff out of your pocket, you put it there, you walk through, and so I wouldn't be opposed to that at casinos because, again, you know, you would think that maybe casinos would be a place where people would want to rob, regardless of the CWP signs or not. You know, obviously, you know, the old saying, why do you rob the bank? Because that's where the money is, right?
Right.
You know, obviously, I think you're pretty stupid doing a casino because there's cameras everywhere, but I don't think it'd be an affront to me to have to walk through a simple metal detector walking.
No, me neither.
If that's the middle ground we have, that I'd be happy to make that middle ground.
Me too. Find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game? Not sure what the proper ruling should have been? Email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. We'll have Hollywood Casino Toledo Director of Poker Elliot Schechter tell you how he would have ruled. Comes from Jeff Hayashi. Says, in many Las Vegas card rooms, they do the following when playing a kill pot. If there are only callers or folders in front of the killer, then the killer acts after the big blind, as is somewhat standard. However, if there is a raise in front of the killer, then the killer acts in turn. I have yet to encounter a dealer that can explain to me why this is. It makes no sense to me why action in front of the killer would change the order of future action.
Elliot says a posted kill is for all intents and purposes the big blind for that hand. In standard games and non-kill pots, the big blind acts last unless the pot is raised. The principle exactly applies to a kill blind as well. Why should any player, killer or otherwise, be allowed to wait until all action is complete before acting upon their hands? A big blind or kill is not guaranteed the button last action for every bet or raise in the opening betting round, nor should they be. Most players in some card rooms misconstrue kill has last action to mean last action regardless of the betting, and this is simply not true. The kill is simply the de facto big blind and should be treated as such.
A lot of things here. One, it seems so insensitive now to call the killer after we just read the thing about the shooting. But the other thing, too, is here we are saying, what player has the right to wait till everyone's done before they act in their hands? Well, if you go to Dallas, down the street, you can do that.
Well, and I will interject real quick before I don't want to detract your train of thought, but I did preface this email to Elliot by saying, hey, we just had this ultimate straddle discussion on the show, because that's what Jeff was writing in about.
Yeah.
But his question wasn't about that. His question had nothing to do with that. And I think Jeff made a good point in response to me that it seems like Elliot's answer is more geared toward the ultimate straddle rather than his question, which is the kill.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I don't know either. But yeah, all the more reason to not play kill pot games.
Kill pots is different than a straddle, because a straddle, you are changing the action on a whim. Mm-hmm. Kill, you are, it's an agreement between all players that once, you know, somebody scoops a pot or wins two pots and hold them, then their limits go up, whether you're a half step or a full step, And players like me love that because now it brings in players from both sides. So if you are a bigger player, you'll play a lower game if it has a kill because you know at some point you're going to be playing the level you want. And if you are a lower player, then you're not too worried about playing that game because you're not going to play that higher level very often. And if you do, you can tighten up or whatever you want to, right?
Right, right.
So I think kills are great. So, but again, our back and forth with Jeff, this is where it's confusing, is some rooms will the kill plays in turn always. And that, I think, is more a function of what we've kind of talked about with the straddle, is that it's just for the ease of the game. It doesn't confuse people as much.
Right.
I don't think it's necessarily proper, but I can understand why rooms want to do it because it keeps it easier. It keeps the game going quicker. People don't get confused. They'd skip him. Now the big blind checks, and then, oh, yeah, nope, sorry, whatever. You know, all that kind of stuff, right? But the proper way is to have the killer act after all the action, the initial action, not the ultimate action, the initial action, unless there's a raise. So... And I understand why he's confused by this, but my point to him was that when there's a raise, it changes my action as the killer. I'm being forced to put this money in the pot, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I deserve the right to protect my hand. Now, if somebody folds in front of me or limps, it doesn't change anything. But when you raise, now I should have an opportunity to control my money in that pot. And what I told him is that I do not want to give up that right to re-raise that guy and shut out the rest of the players if that's what I want to do. Or I can just fold and get out of the way, that's fine, or call if I want. But I really want that. I want that opportunity as quickly as possible, and obviously that happens in order. So there is a big difference in my mind between a raise and a limp call.
Yeah.
And it's because I want to protect my hand. I don't know if that's actually the reason. Obviously, I didn't get into that. But that's the reason I would insist on being able to act as soon as somebody raises.
You do that, Scott. You insist.
I do. I'm going to insist.
We have a brand new O'Malley's move. Here it comes.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week we're seated at a $1, $2, no-limit hold'em, short-handed home game. There are only 5 players at the table, and no one is getting much respect for their pre-flop raises, especially since it's short-handed. We know these players very well, as this is our regular home game. Everyone bought in for $200, and it's fairly early in the night. Not a lot of chips have exchanged hands. The blinds post, the under-the-gun folds, and we're in the cutoff with the Jack of Spades, Jack of Diamonds. This is a very good hand pre-flop, five-handed, so we're going to make a raise. The standard has been 3 to 4x big blind, so we err on the heavier side and make it 8 to go. The button calls, which is exactly what we didn't want, but the blinds get out of the way. There's $19 in the pot, and we see a beautiful flop of the Ace of Hearts, Jack of Clubs, 7 of Spades. We are going to proceed with this hand, hoping for the world. Our raise could look like a raise with kings or queens, so in this case, we're going to check and hope it looks like we're afraid of the ace. Our opponent may then either A, represent the ace, or 2, actually have it and bet for value. Our opponent is a tight passive player during tournaments, but in the cash games, he tends to be more loose passive, a peculiar shift in styles. If he's betting into a pot, it's probably because he has something. But he does play position very well. He started the hand with about 195 to our 205. Our opponent does exactly what we wanted. He bets $12 into the $19 pot. We call. There's a little more than $40 in the pot when the turn brings the 4 of hearts. Okay, that card puts a flush draw on the board, so we're going to come alive now. If he has some kind of a draw, we want to make him pay to see the river and hope the board pairs. The 7 of hearts would be nice. We make it $40 to go, and after some genuine hemming and hawing, he makes the call. There's now 120 in the pot, and the river is the queen of hearts. So, did we just lose this one? Are we checking here? Or are we betting for value? And if so, how much are we betting? What's the move?
It's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast at antiupmagazine.com. This week's prize is an upgraded membership to PokerRadius.com. Poker's best social networking site and home of the Antiup group discussions. Comes all the way from Down Under, Tyrone Keel, He says that I'm an Australian player in the state of Queensland. First time sending in an email. Let's see. We'll just skip right to the end here. All right. This is a hand from a recent National Poker League tournament at one of the local pubs in town. This free poker is really big in Australia. I remember from previous listeners, right?
Right.
He says, we have pretty strict gambling laws in the state, so this is a free roll, but with cash prizes and entries into major tournaments that have substantial prizes and even trips that go to Las Vegas and play the World Series. So people do tend to take these games seriously despite the stigma that surrounds free rolls. Starting stacks are 30,000 with 25-50 starting blinds and 15-minute levels. So he says we do get some play and some ample opportunity to make some moves. This hand took place early in the evening when blinds were 100, 200, and the table of eight still had roughly near the starting stack, plus or minus a few hundred chips. As I know all the players at the table, having played with them all many times, there's a real mixed bag of play styles at the table. We've got tight, passive, loose, aggressive, and a few tight aggressive, of which I am one. I am under the gun with ace of spades, king of diamonds.
Okay. Well, standard raise, right? I don't know. Make it 100, 200, so make it 600, I guess. Or, I mean, again, everyone knows it depends on what. Maybe that table is looser and everyone's playing 800 raise or whatever, but standard is 3x. I don't see any reason not to make it 3x. You can make it 2x if you want to do the Chris Ferguson rule because you're under the gun.
2.5x.
2.5x if you want to do the Jonathan Little Scott Long tag team rule.
Though I will say, again, it's interesting because it's free roll, right? So I know he went to great lengths to tell us that there's some big prizes here, so people played a little seriously. More seriously than normal. But I think my standard raise might be a little bit bigger in games like that, I would think. Also, the other thing is that, you know, what I think about ace-king. So I'm not sure I want to commit a lot of chips here pre-flop. Of course, now we have 30,000. These are deep stacks.
Yeah.
So, you know, 500. Even if I make this 1,000 to go, that's nothing at this point. So, but definitely raising.
Okay. So we'll raise.
All right, Arthur says, knowing the players as I do, I can pretty well test how most will respond. I know a raise will see some respect, but I'll definitely get a few callers. On the other hand, a call might help disguise my hand, and I've been known to make such a play. I'm going to bet here knowing that I will see at least a few callers to the flop and have a chance to build a pot. My first question is, how much is a good bet in this position? All right, well, we kind of gave you a range there. They were good. He says, knowing the other players, I decide to put in a bet of 1,200 here, making it 5x to go. Going around the table, I get three callers, including the undergun plus two, the cutoff, and the big blind. And he says, I'm going to categorize the three villains in the hand. Undergun plus one is a young, loose, aggressive player and has a pretty big range of hands he could be playing here. The cutoff is an older gentleman who is tight, passive player, so I know his range is pretty limited. And the big blind is another tight passive player, so again, the range is pretty tight in the situation. So it's four to the flop, and the cards come out. Jack of spades, queen of hearts, ten of hearts. Pretty good flop. And it says the big blind takes a moment and checks, and the action is now on us.
Let's see. So, tell me the flop again. Ace of spades.
Jack of spades.
No, Jack of spades.
Queen of hearts, ten of hearts. So we flop Broadway.
Yeah.
Obviously a hard draw out there and lots of big cards that might have hit some other folks.
Well, it's kind of suspicious if you don't bet it. I mean, you know, I mean, you could have been raising with pocket nines and you're afraid, but other than that, this flop pretty much hits anybody who raises under the gun. So, you know, at some point, if you have king queen, you've hit it. If you know what I mean. So, at some point, you've hit this flop, and you need to bet. So, I'm just going to bet, you know, 2/3 the pot. You know, just because I don't want to. I always bet my hands when I hit them. I don't not bet them. You know, I want to get value for them. I want to do stuff that looks like, you know, I would have done. You know, every time a flop comes, people bet. They always see bet almost always. So, if you don't, it's suspicious. So, I'm betting.
Yeah, especially when you're under the gun. So, and this is going to be a trend that comes up in future hands of the week because we've gotten a lot lately, and I've been responding to folks where they are inclined to check here. And what I always say to them is, the check makes you look super fishy. And so what happens now? Well, also you have the hearts here you have to worry about too. So all the more reason to bet here to kind of protect against those, or at least pay people to draw out on you.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. When you're under the gun, you raise, and then you don't c-bet. People start to wonder, and particularly this board is hard not to c-bet on. I mean, there may be situations where an ace is there, and then maybe you can try to sell the fact that you have pocket kings and missed or worried about the ace. There's no ace or king here. We got the ace and the king.
Yeah.
So there's really nothing about this flop that should scare an under the gun raiser. So let's go ahead and bet. And on top of that, if somebody doesn't believe me, this is exactly when I don't want them to believe me.
Yeah.
When I have the nuts.
Yeah.
So if somebody says, "Oh, he's just making a move now," great, let him raise, and then I'll re-raise, and you know, I'm happy here.
I agree.
All right. Here it says, this is a dream flop for me. I flopped the nut straight, but being the pre-flop raising situation means that no doubt the three villains have to guess what I caught, at least a piece of this board. In turn, there's no doubt in my mind that one, two, or maybe all three have caught a piece as well. The pot is 4,900, and the next question is what to do in this position. I know checking is a very valid move in this position, but even though it's a relatively safe board, there are two hearts on the board, so I'm wary of possible flush draw in the group. I do not want to give up my pre-flop raise advantage either, so I'm going to bet here more to see how everyone else is situated in the hand, and I bet 2,500.
Well, one thing is he says, I know checking is very valid. I don't know about very valid. That to me, when you have multiple people, yeah, I mean, if you have multiple people in the pot with you, you've got the nuts and you want to protect your hand, and you took initiative and raised pre-flop, so you have the control.
Well, and the other thing is he mentioned is that he feels pretty confident that this flop hit everybody at the table.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much.
If the flop hit everybody at the table, why would I want to check and give up that value, right?
Yeah, you want to get value and protect at the same time, so.
If I felt reasonably confident that everybody missed this flop, then that would be a different story, but.
I also don't know if I agree with 2,500. That's only 50% of the pot here. I would do that later on to control the pot, but here I'm looking to get some value and maybe get some people out. You know, maybe get heads up with the flush draw or whatever, you know, or something. But I don't know if 2,500 is the right bet. I probably would have bet a little more than that, maybe 35 or whatever.
Yeah. I'm fine with the 2,500. I probably would have bet more as well, too, but I'm fine with it. So we'll find other ways to criticize Tyrone here. All right, he says, probably a little weak bet, but I also want one to maybe call. But the other players have other ideas. Under the gun plus two raises here to 5,000 without too much thought. The cutoff calls pretty quickly, and it goes to the big blind, who does take some time before he too calls the 5,000. Now I'm blown away in this position. I hadn't expected to see that much action on this hand.
Well, we know what's going to happen now. We obviously have the nuts. We obviously can't afford all these people in the hand with us, and we know at least one of them is on the draw. Somebody probably has the same hand as us.
That's possible, or
a smaller straight. That's possible, right? It's the nine. You could have
nine king.
So I'm shoving, because if there's so much money out there, we only had about 30. If we're going to re-raise again and make it 15, now we have less. That's more than 50% of what stack that we have. So I'm just going to shove. Why not? You got the absolute top end of the straight nuts, and you know, the only thing you're going to lose to is if the board pairs and somebody has a set or two pair, or if the flush gets there and you got. I'm not getting out of this. I'm not calling. Right. For what? What does that acquire? So,
Well, plus if we get everybody to fold, which is probably unlikely even with our shove, that's 20,000 we just picked up. We've almost doubled our starting stack.
Yeah.
At the 100-200 level, so. There's enough value in this hand now that even if everything folds, I'm happy with. But I think we're in agreement that there's a possibility that somebody's going to call here. And it could be the other ace king, and then we just split up the money, but that's fine. But it could be somebody else that's overvalues their hand. And I'd be happy to fade two cards with that person.
Me too. So you're shoving.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, initially I probably was thinking maybe like 15,000, but you're right at that point. You know, I'm committed. And then what happens if a heart comes next? I mean, I guess maybe there's an argument to make for making a 15,000, but there's three people that have committed 5,000 here. So
yeah.
I would rather just find out who's really serious about this hand right now than mess around any longer.
I feel like the guy who raised probably has the same hand as us, or has that king nine that we're
talking about. So I guess I'm curious what you think too. I'm gonna guess there's probably an ace king here. I think there's definitely a flush draw here, and probably a set, right?
Yeah, or two pair,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. Our hero says, I take a few minutes to try to mentally compose myself here and decide on how best to respond. I put at least one of the players on a flush draw. I know now that there is at least a straight draw or two calling the re-raise. A straight draw or two calling the re-raise. I decide to put the table to the test, and I push all in. Well, there we go.
There you go. All right, good.
So at this point, I'm not sure if this is the right decision. I flopped the ace high straight, but the flush draw is worrying. All the more reason to shove, because now the odds aren't there, right? I can't really get away from this hand, so hopefully I've made the right decision. I think you have. All right, under the gun, pauses for a moment or two, and calls. Cutoff pushes all in over the top because he had a little extra than we did. And the big blind sits and analyzes the hand pretty thoroughly before making a crying call.
Oh my gosh.
I certainly don't like my hand. This is like the least excited I am about having the nuts ever, right? Because it probably means, again, that we definitely have another ace king here, I think, right?
Yeah.
So definitely splitting this thing if we... But we're also going to have to fade not one hand, but two hands. Hopefully they both have hearts, and that kills the hearts.
Yeah, right.
But I don't think we're going to be that lucky, right? It's going to be exactly what we're talking about before, I think, and we're going to have to fade a lot of cards here.
Just to split the pot.
Yeah, just to split the pot. Wow. All right. After getting the pot sorted, I show my ace high straight. Under the gun plus two shows ace of clubs, nine of clubs.
What?
For an open-ended gut shot straight draw. Or open-ended, I guess.
It can be both.
Cutoff shows the ace of hearts, king of spades. All right, there we go. There's our split.
There's our split. Yay.
And lastly, the big blind shows queen of clubs, ten of spades for two pair.
Wow, no flush draws.
Yeah, I'm happy about that.
All you got to do is worry about runners or the board pairing the queen and the ten.
Yep.
Wow.
I feel a lot better now. Obviously, I'm upset that I'm splitting the spot, hopefully. Yeah. But, best case scenario, I'm splitting the spot. But, wow. He says, now myself in the cutoff is winning a queen or ten, but the turn sees a nine of diamonds and a five of hearts on the river, and we split this massive pot, knocking out two players in the process. He says, in retrospect, this is easily the biggest hand I've been involved in, especially with four players all in on the flop. I'm interested to hear opinions on the way the three villains in this hand played their hand out. My reasoning is the undergun is loose aggressive, so with this draw on the flop, he tried to push us three out of the hand. The cutoff being tight passive was happy to call over the flop ace high straight. The big blind had two pair and was banking on boating up. When I put it all in, only the undergun plus two had substantial reason for folding, in my opinion. I don't know. I think the big blind probably should have, too. At this point, he only had a draw to possibly a split hand at best at showdown. Cutoff has flopped the nut straight and has a backdoor flush draw with his ace of hearts, and the big blind knows he's up against at least one main hand, possibly two, but has four outs to hit his boat and take the gamble. I'm going to say the big blind should have folded easily here. Set might be a different story. But two pair, I can't feel is good there.
No, plus
draw.
Exactly. I mean, the types of hands you could be up against there easily are sets, or the made Broadway, or king nine. I mean, clearly queen ten is not good enough. Whoever had ace nine, ask him after the tournament if he wants to play heads up for the rest of his life.
Yeah, I think that he really misjudged there because, you know, obviously doing that bet on the come is a powerful move, but not in a situation when you have this many people in the hand.
Yeah, no.
And that kind of flop. So, I mean, as it turns out, he was really drawing dead there. So,
man.
We're not drawing dead. I guess he could have...
He could have tied.
Could have tried for a third of the pot.
He could have gotten the king somehow and then split it, but yeah. Wow, that was just sad. That guy right there needs to learn how to play poker. Now, that's what you're up against when you're playing in these free leagues.
Right.
So, but, wow. Well, at least we split it and didn't lose.
Yep, and he says, I ended up making third in the tournament, making the final table as chip leader after tripling up on pocket aces against ace king and ace queen, and I pocketed a sweet $20 for 3 hours and a bit hour, three and a bit hours of work. Haha.
Three and a bit, wow. See, that's how they say it in Australia. All right, well, good hand. That's it's always good when our players win. You know, I hate it when they always end up losing. I always dread it, especially when they get it all in like that. You want to see how they're going to lose.
And really, I would say he probably didn't make too many mistakes, or any. I'm trying to think what mistakes he would have made.
Well, we talked about maybe betting a little more after the flop, right. But that really wasn't too bad. That wasn't a bad mistake. It was just maybe a little. And then we said the raise amount. What did he raise pre-flop to? Trying to see now. Oh,
1,200?
No, I mean pre-flop.
Oh, pre-flop 1,200, yes.
Right, 1,200. So that was pretty large. But, again, you were talking about we're deep stacked, and it's a free-roll tournament. Probably make a little bit more than normal. So that could have been what was going on throughout the first few rounds. So I don't really fault him there too much. So, yeah, sounds right. I think he did okay in this hand.
Sure.
I definitely approve of the shove. You know, that's 100%. You had to do that. So, right. Played it well. Way to go, Tyrone. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@anteupmagazine.com or call our hotline at 206-338-6344. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@anteupmagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.